I have directed Secretary Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets.
Where is the gold?
This is the Gold News Letter podcast. Thanks for tuning in. If you'd like more mining, precious metals, economic freedom, please do hit that subscribe button. If you want to see our archives, go to goldnewsletter.com/podcast. At goldnewsletter.com, we always also have newsletters if you want to look more into recommendations for your investments. Now, we have JP Cortez today. He is the policy director of the Sound Money Defense League. As you know, Sound Money is just near and dear to the Gold Newsletter's tradition or history. And he is also, they've also released the Sound Money Index just recently. So we've got some news to report now. JP, welcome to the show. And why don't you tell us, I mean, maybe this is a softball, but why should we care about Sound Money? I actually read a book recently. What is it called? Oh, man. I read recently. That inflation isn't that big of a deal. There's a book by a British economist saying that the actual impact on growth is limited, up to about 40%. So why is sound money such a critical issue for you and so many others?
Hey, Fergus, thank you so much for having me on. First of all, I've followed the show for a while. I followed your work for a while, so it's great to finally chat with you. Why sound money is so important? You know, I think... sound money, outside of language, outside of communication using words, money is the single most communicative tool that human beings use to express their desires and their wants and their needs, right? So money as a communicative tool, it's a signal sender. Prices themselves are information. None of this stuff is arbitrary or made up. And so when government manipulates these signals, when they control the money supply and they do their best to kind of map things out using very complex regressions and analysis, they sort of separate the human element of it. And that's a problem because sound money does primarily two things, right? It's important on one side because it allows people to accumulate. It allows people to save and plan for the future. This is largely how societies are built. This is how living standards are increased. Standards of living are increased by the capital accumulation and investment back into the community, the civilization. But for example, if you wanted to make a long-term land deal, you know, and at this point we're seeing inflation higher than it's been in decades, you would have a really hard time trying to figure out the most simple of issues, which is, well, what's my dollar going to be worth a year from now? Or 2 years from now, 10 years from now. And so this makes it extremely difficult to plan long term. And so that's half of it. That's the human side of it. That's the civilization, the interpersonal workings of why sound money is important. The other side, and perhaps the bigger side, is that sound money acts as a safeguard against big government, acts as a bulwark or a protection against a government that would otherwise spend recklessly, be it endless wars overseas or wasteful domestic programs. All of these things are possible. They're enabled by a government that has access to an endless printing press. And that's why sound money matters. We're seeing, again, the effects of this inflation. People that were already struggling to afford basic necessities, housing, food, transportation, their lives are becoming harder because of this intentional policy choice to devalue the money. It's a moral wrong. It's theft.
Mm. Yeah. So the first one is basically it impedes our understanding of the economy and allocations. And I'm just back from Argentina a couple of weeks ago, and there are no mortgages there. You can't make loans because no one knows what the peso will be worth in a year or two. And secondly, you basically referred to what I would say the inflation tax, that it's another form of taxation. This is why the full-on socialists want this modern monetary theory. They just want to print it without any limit and just say, okay, we'll just make the money work for the government and not for the people. Okay, and just to confirm, the book that I was referring to, is called Bad Samaritans, and it is, and it's one someone gave to me as basically a critique of capitalism, and from a smart guy, the myth of free trade and the secret history of capitalism. So it's worth your time just to get the other side of the story. It's one of the smarter critiques. Now, this issue of sound money is becoming more, let's say, acute because people are now feeling the effects of all this loose monetary policy for the last 20 odd years, really, even longer. And it surprised even me the way that inflation has crept up on Americans. This is an extremely productive place, and yet so you've got to print money pretty quickly to inflate the value. Now, the challenge I always have is how in my own life can I basically opt out or say no thanks to the Federal Reserve notes? And I have a hard time doing that. So why don't you tell people how you can, I mean, you're on the battle line. So what can the troops do to support you?
I think it's important to start with the understanding that this problem, right, this inflation problem that we're seeing today, these price increases that we're seeing, this is not an act of God. This was not an accident. This is an intentional policy choice, right? And so we begin from there, the idea that the federal government and the Federal Reserve caused this by intense money mismanagement. This was an intentional choice, and that was brought upon us. So with that understanding that most of this dysfunction stems from the federal level, there are still things states themselves can do, right? States don't have to stand by and sort of wait around and watched as citizens get fleeced. Ultimately, I think, you know, the federal government isn't coming to save us, and neither is the Federal Reserve. I think what's best, really, as far as I'm concerned, would be for them to get the hell out of the way. But, and so states themselves can enable this process, right? Human beings, you, me, people in trade, people in commerce, we want a stable money. This makes it, like I mentioned earlier, easier to plan, easier to accumulate, easier to decipher the economy's signals. But we can't do that many times because you and I personally would have a really difficult time adopting our own gold standard, our own Bitcoin standard, our own sound money standard. The reason for that is largely because of all of the regulations and the taxation that surround the sale, the use, and the purchase of these alternative monies. So what the Sound Money Defense League does, we work on the federal level as well. We recently, Congressman Alex Mooney from West Virginia recently introduced a bill to reestablish the gold standard. We've been working closely with Congressman Mooney's office for that. But most of the policy work that we do is actually on the state level, because states themselves, in many cases, can remove a lot of these disincentives and a lot of the friction into and out of the dollar. There are some states here in the United States that will charge you sales tax when you buy gold or silver. And so, for example, if you walk into a gas station today and you exchange four quarters for $1, this is a non-taxable event. You're just exchanging one form of money for another. The same is true with U.S. Federal Reserve notes and, for example, let's say a gold eagle or a silver eagle. But in eight states across the country, you're hit with that tax for purchasing the metal. In most states, you're also hit with a capital gains tax when you sell the metal, and then the federal government will charge you again. That's triple taxation on sound money. So there are so many restrictions, there is so much friction that make it impossible for people to adopt their own gold standard. You know, buying a piece of gold and or buying a couple of ounces of silver and trying to use them at the grocery store, having to track your cost basis, having to go through the whole rigmarole every time of when you exchange these metals, this sound money, it just makes it unfeasible. So that's kind of the idea, removing the disincentives and letting people choose, letting people adopt their own sound money standard.
You're killing me with all these talks of taxes. It breaks my heart.
It's horrible. And like, it's not by accident. You know, in the case of the state is looking, the tax revenue hungry politicians wanting this money because they believe that there's a gold mine, you know, to be mined with precious metals purchases. And then there's the IRS, for example, that has unilaterally decided that gold and silver bullion are a collectible. So it's in the same tax category as Beanie Babies or baseball cards or artwork, which subjects it to a discriminatorily high 28% capital gains rate. So, you know, and I don't think any of this is by accident. The U.S. wants you using the Federal Reserve note, and they're making it, and they have made it difficult to use anything other than that.
Yeah, basic economics tells you that anyone with a monopoly has less incentive to serve you and is going to try to protect that monopoly, which is exactly what happens with the federal government. And it's so anti-American because, of course, we know that in the U.S. Constitution, it refers to the coining of money, not to the printing of the press. So they referred to, I think they were silver coins at the time, but basically they meant gold and silver. And hard money, which could not be just printed out of nothing. So we have this scenario, and it is sound. Let me get your website up here. Soundmoneydefense.org is the website if you want to check out JP's work. And you've got. Let's go through this index then, because from memory, last time I checked, Wyoming was number one. And going to 2023, are they still holding on to top spot?
They are, yeah. So this year, there has been a lot of movement throughout the index. There are several states that have passed legislation that have greatly changed their score, largely on the sales tax issue. There are also, you know, more than a dozen states that have introduced legislation on this stuff as well. So like you mentioned, Wyoming rounds out the top. Wyoming, South Dakota, Alaska, Texas, and Utah. New Hampshire is up there as well. And these are all states that have actively passed legislation to provide a pro-sound money environment in their states. So these are states that have eliminated sales tax on precious metals, eliminated capital gains tax. In some cases, they have established an in-state gold depository. There are states that have invested public funds, so reserve funds, pension funds, in physical gold. So to protect their state taxpayer funds, states that have eliminated, there are rules. We call them precious metals dealer harassment laws. There are laws all over the country. Each state has different laws that say that, you know, if you're operating a bullion shop and someone comes in and wants to buy a gold eagle from you or sell you a gold eagle, you have to collect all sorts of really overbearing information, the height, weight, skin color, tattoos, eye color, any noticeable scars. You take all this information, you have to put the eagle aside in your supply. You're not allowed to move it for, it could be a week, it could be 2 weeks. In a market that's constantly moving like precious metals, tying up your inventory for that long is very bad business. And on top of all the information gathering, in some states, you have to upload this information to a police database at the end of every week. I think the idea is, you know, if your grandmother's brooch or necklace is stolen, sure, you might be able to find that. It's a pretty unique piece. But in the case of a gold eagle or a silver eagle that are all commonly made, you're not going to find a silver eagle that's been fenced based on information about the eagle. You're just essentially putting the onus on the business dealer to try to collect all of this information and then report it to the police with nothing to gain most times.
Mm. It almost reminds me of the raw milk scenario where the milk processors do not want people buying just direct from the producer. And although in many states like Colorado, where I am, you can still technically get it by basically buying a share of your own cow and then having access to that cow. But the burden is so onerous that 95% of people just don't want to deal with it.
Yeah.
So you can't just go to Whole Foods and pick up raw milk. Now, and as you said, these taxes, and it's almost like a regulatory prohibition in that the burden is so great in some instances that it just makes it infeasible to hold. And then people go and buy ETFs instead as a kind of cheaper or more accessible alternative, but it's not the real deal. And do you explore the benefits or shortcomings of paper gold or derivatives of gold?
Just even, we'll take a step back from there. Not even gold derivatives, just paper markets in general, ETFs, mutual funds, stocks, bonds, right? Yeah. In many cases, states don't tax the purchase of of these assets. These are assets that are held for resale. So there isn't a state in the country, I don't think, that charges sales tax on the purchase of these assets, primarily because they're held for resale. The point isn't to use them. It's not a consumable good the way a hamburger or a piece of clothing might be. They're held for resale. And so they're taxed on any potential gain that you have on the back end. But in the case of precious metals, you're taxed as if it were a consumable good and then taxed again as if it were a capital asset. So it's just incredibly unfair. And the legislators oftentimes that are against this will talk about how, you know, metals should be taxed because they don't want to pick winners and losers. And so the tax should remain, without the understanding that the tax itself is choosing winners and losers. It's completely kneecapping a gold market that might otherwise flourish because of all the taxes and all of the things that surround it. Like you said, it makes it unreasonable or unfeasible. It's regulatory overload. It can't be used, not feasibly anyway. And so like and even you can even go further, like the pension market, the pension funds and the reserve funds that a lot of these states have that are investing in risky ETFs, stocks, mutual funds, you know, many times emerging world debt. And with because of inflation the way it is now, many times they have a negative real rate of return. And all of that considered, many of these states don't own a single ounce of gold without any consideration for counterparty risk or protection of principal or anything like that. So there's everyone likes gambling in this casino, these paper markets, even on the gold side as well, right? On the paper gold side as well, as you know, obviously very heavily trafficked, and you know, gold. This market is massive and constantly moving. But you don't have that. There are differences there as far as the benefits to the asset, that being counterparty risk, largely. And so when a state or an individual is concerned with counterparty risk, when you're concerned of the IOU that you're holding potentially defaulting, then that becomes incredibly important to you. You're not willing to necessarily gamble at the casino. You might be more willing to hold these metals as a question of insurance more than a money-making play.
The Gold Newsletter is proudly sponsored by Inventa Capital Corporation, a venture capital advisory firm dedicated to the acquisition and development of assets in the natural resource sector. Today, Inventa is one of the premier mining groups with a first-rate portfolio of companies and a world-class team.
This is the Inventa Capital Mining Update. I've got Craig Parry, Executive Chairman of Vizsla Copper. That is VizslaCopper.com. On the Toronto Venture Exchange, it is VCU, and over-the-counter VCUFF for Americans. Now, we're recording this on Thanksgiving Day, so November 24th, and they actually have a press release out today. So you've got three projects, but one is the chief focus, and that's been, do you want to clarify, finalized? What's the outcome of the latest, let's say, consolidation?
Yeah, sure. Well, look, happy Thanksgiving. I hope everyone's having a good one, and you know, there's a lot to give thanks about this year. So look, we spun Vizsla Copper out of Vizsla Silver about 12 months ago, and we've been really focused on building up a bigger land position and acquiring quality projects, primarily in British Columbia, primarily for the great metal that is copper. And so we achieved that. We announced this morning that we had court approval for the merger of the two companies. And so that, you know, now sees us really move all of our focus predominantly to the Woodjam project, which is an extraordinary suite of already proven porphyry district. There's some fantastic proven porphyries there. You know, the Woodjam guys drilled out a number of those porphyries, proved up a large resource. I think we've got nearly 1 million ounces of gold in resource. A couple of billion pounds of copper, 1.7 billion pounds of copper, I should say. You know, fairly low-grade stuff. But what drew us into the area, what really excites us about it, is the fact that some of these areas where there isn't a resource yet have had really spectacular drill hits that fell on deaf ears. They were put out typically 10 years ago in the depths of the last mining depression, really. And the market didn't really appreciate, hasn't even seen a lot of those drill holes. So we'll be refreshing all of that, drilling in and around those. We've got some basic work, geophysical surveys. We want to do a VTEM survey over the entire area and then get in and follow up where the guys drilled years ago and that the market hasn't appreciated. And, there's some examples, for example, at our gold-rich Deerhorn porphyry system where the guys drilled 110 metres at 2.6 grams per tonne gold and 0.44% copper. So nearly, 3 grams gold or 3% copper equivalent over 110 metres. That's never been put into a resource. So over the next 6 months, you'll see a lot of news refreshing that, just going back and looking. I'm, of course, the chairman of Skeena Resources. We acquired the Escape Creek project off Barrick a couple of years ago. And I think everyone had assumed that all of that gold had been mined out. Well, the resource base there at Escape Creek's now over 5 million ounces of gold and gold equivalent. And all of that was largely discovered at the desktop level by going back over old data. So we'll be doing that here. I think you'll see resource upgrades over the next 12 months as well. But the primary thing for us is alerting the market to what we actually have here in this transaction and getting in and following up where those drill holes haven't been followed up and drilling in and around those areas. So, the news flow is going to be absolutely spectacular once we hit the ground running early in the new year.
Do you want to comment on the location? This place is near somewhere called Horsefly, which is way up there in British Columbia. I don't know what the weather's like at this time of the year, but when you say the information flow can keep coming, how do you handle a project in that isolated place?
It's not actually that isolated. It's 30 kilometres from the major regional centre of Williams Lake. It's fairly flat terrain, certainly probably a balmy 0 degrees there today, but very close to the existing Mount Polly mine. Good road access. We can operate year round, which is important. If anyone's ever heard me talk about how you rank and prioritize exploration projects, size of the prize, cost of the test, chance of success, well, that cost of the test is so important. And so having good road access is important. And we've got year round road access. There are forestry trails all through the area, including new forestry trails. And we were up there a couple of months ago. And in a new road cut that was put in by the loggers up there, we found some seriously interesting copper staining and alteration at surface in a new road cut in an area that hasn't been explored at all in the past. So it's starting to uncover the potential there, but you can operate year round. So you'll see new news flow continuously from us. The great thing about being in BC as well, it's a known porphyry district. And of course, we've got that existing resource base. So it's proven. But there are a lot of porphyry centres here that haven't been tested, haven't been drilled. Raising capital to do that is relatively non-dilutive and straightforward compared to most other parts of the world because we have access to flow through funding here, flow through capital. And importantly, the government here has brought in further incentives for battery and electrification metals, including copper. So we can raise money at a serious premium to our share price through flow through funds and flow through sources of capital. So, we're in great shape to hit the ground running, get in and start drilling as soon as we've confirmed all the targets that we're working on at the moment. A very, very exciting project. It's heating up this area. We're starting to see new deals being done all the time in the district. I can tell you that as of today, all of the majors, including some of the sort of more prominent copper producers of the world have started to take a real interest in the entire central part of British Columbia, this area around us here. So, I think we've got a big area. It's a massive area to explore. Of course, we want to do that as much of that as ourselves as we can. But I think that the opportunity to farm out some of our projects to others and have them explore the ground for us is important as well. But suffice to say, year-round news flow right. and And I think in Inventor Capital today, we've got about 20, 21 rigs turning around the world. And one thing that we do well here is put our investors' dollars into drill holes. So that'll be the focus for us over the next little while.
Right. And as we mentioned before we got recording, it has been a challenging 6 months for junior explorers. And how much of a turning point is this Woodjam acquisition?
Well, it's crucial for us. You know, we've been working away on this for 2 years, so to finally get to this point, I'm absolutely thrilled. It's you know, it's a very, very accretive transaction for all of us. You know, Bill Morton there at Woodjam, a very well regarded and successful explorer. But unfortunately, you know, Bill and his team were working at a time when the market had very little interest in exploration, and particularly copper exploration. So sort of from that period of 2011 to pretty much a couple of years ago. And so they did some fantastic work. They found some tremendous deposits and came up with some brilliant targets, but it all fell on deaf ears, unfortunately. So for us, very, very straightforward. We're good at getting word out about projects. I think we've got a great following in the market now with some of the successes we've had. So, you know, it's a pretty straightforward job for us. The potential of the area is proven. There are existing resources there, the fabulous drill results. And it's just a matter of getting onto the ground, drilling more holes and alerting the market to what we've really got here.
Sure. Folks, you can learn more about it. There's a fresh press release at vizsla.com, on the TSXV at VCU, and over-the-counter VCUFF. We've been speaking with Craig Parry, Executive Chairman of Vizsla Copper. Thanks for your time. Yeah, I mean, in terms of the barriers, it's clear that it is deliberate, because when it comes to international trade, for example, this is a trick as old as they come, that governments will, rather than having an explicit quota or an explicit tariff, will come up with all sorts of complicated regulations that make it very difficult for foreigners to enter the local market. And okay, but so there are some states, the cowboy state, Wyoming, just north of me, is having a crack at this. Does that mean that people in those states tend to hold more precious metals and actually use them for any kind of transactions? Is this actually happening, that more people are resorting to non-US dollar denominated transactions?
I think in general, I think that the US dollar is the most used currency, the most used form of money in international and domestic transactions. It has a massive amount of the market share of all transactions throughout the world. But yeah, I think in general, the inflation becoming more of a touch point and more of an actual problem that people can feel, coupled with, you know, the rise of cryptocurrencies and all of that coming with simply the questions that come to mind of, wait, what is money? Where does money derive its value? What properties should quote unquote good money have? People are asking these questions in the ways that they haven't, you know, for the last several decades. And so the adoption, I think, of again, things like crypto, there are crypto-backed gold projects. There are also physical gold projects. For example, the Gold Back, which is a product. It's a paper with gold inlaying into it. So all of these, they're all movements in this space. They're all in this industry. They're developments that I think, yeah, as the days go on and people sort of begin to understand more that the Federal Reserve is a cabal of unelected bureaucrats and that have no real accountability, and they start looking around and start saying, wait, why is my money worth less today than it was yesterday? Why are prices going up this way? Why is wealth disparity exasperated? Why are these things happening the way they are? And it's asking those questions, I think, because to understand why things end out the way they do, you kind of have to understand how the plumbing works. And people are starting to understand, and they're starting to wake up to the idea that, like, wait, maybe money doesn't have to be this way. And that sort of borrows, like, the Hayekian insight, the denationalization of currency, the competition of currency. You know, maybe money can be the same as dollar bills or lima beans, where markets produce, and then the market that ends up, or the lima bean that ends up on my shelf, is the one that has, you know, been most safely tested and is at a most affordable price point and has all of the qualities that I want in a lima bean.
Man, I'm excited about that day coming. And yeah, so you're right that there is, in my view, there has been a rising awareness. I mean, obviously Ron Paul got the ball rolling back in 2018, 2012, when he campaigned on ending the Fed, basically. But then since then, we've dealt with inflation, and the challenge is that for maybe two generations, people have seen the U.S. dollar as the place to go to for safety. But then the question is, okay, well, what if the U.S. dollar isn't there? What next? Where else can we go? And I don't see a likely candidate. Probably the most prominent one would be the Swiss franc, although it's not used widely in international trade. It's one currency that has held relative stability. But it does seem that whether it's cryptocurrencies or cryptocurrencies backed by some kind of precious metal, that we are entering a new era when some kind of alternative can begin to compete. Now, you mentioned the fact that there's a rising awareness. Does that mean, assuming politics is downstream from culture, does that mean some politicians are getting on this bandwagon?
I think we've seen that, right? I think in Wyoming, like you mentioned earlier, there have been several outspoken fans of Bitcoin and sound money in general. Warren Davidson from Ohio established the Sound Money Caucus. Alex Mooney, like I mentioned earlier, has introduced several gold standard bills. And then, of course, the Rand Pauls and the Thomas Massey's that often, you know, give voice at least to the idea. So, yeah, I think we're seeing it as far as elected official goes, as far as elected officials go. We're seeing more and more of that on the grassroots side, on people just living in any given state. The last couple of years have been tremendous. The amount of growth, the amount of interest in this topic, the amount of emails and phone calls I regularly get from either state legislators or people in the state saying, hey, I came across your work. I would like to do this in my state. Please, how do we do this and how do we make this happen? That's something that has grown tenfold since we've started the project. And so I think part of it is like elected officials, and that being important. Part of it is the industry moving forward and the developments like on the entrepreneur side, on the sales side, if you will, that being like creating the tokens, creating the money, creating the infrastructure that governs these financial systems. And so the Sound Money Defense League, like what we do on the policy side, that's, I think, half of what we do, right? The actual passing of legislation to eliminate these taxes or to bolster state funds or to invest in gold bonds. That's the legislative part. The other half, I think, is the education part. There are more than 7,000 elected officials, state legislators across the country in the United States. Most of them have probably never heard the term sound money. Most of them have probably never given much thought to what money is or where it comes from or what makes good money. And so there's a massive disconnect between what people in general think money printing does, because when people think money printing, they think, oh, this money is going to help poor people. It's going to help unfunded programs. It's going to, you know, help a war effort, you know, this or that. And that's largely what people believe happens when money is printed. But the reality is that, like, we're seeing the effects of what actually happens, that being price inflation, that being wealth disparity, the Cantillon effects, you know, those most closely connected to the money, the financiers, the bankers, the politicians, those are people that enjoy the value, that enjoy they get to reap the benefits of new money before prices have adjusted. And by the time that money trickles down to us, we're stuck with these higher inflated prices. So I think having the opportunity to speak to these legislators directly, the people that are, you know, ostensibly making decisions that affect your life and my life and the life of everyone around us, and being able to have those conversations with them and help them understand that this inflation problem isn't an act of God, but rather something that we can actively fix. And there are things that the states can do. I think that so the education side, I think, is just as valuable as the actual policy and legislative side as well.
Yeah, and there's an important article by George Selgin on the future of the gold standard and how it may or may not ever come into be again. And I'll link to that in the show notes. He discusses the way that the gold standard rose spontaneously or organically, and then was basically codified by legislators. So it's very unlikely that legislators could basically reinvent that or do that over again. There has to be some sort of bottom-up movement there. Now, so that's why, as you said, the entrepreneurs in this space are so crucial. And I personally support informal markets as well, people using these alternatives off the books, so to speak, because I just am concerned that, as you said, the burden is so high that in day-to-day living, well, it's just impossible to comply with. Let's say every time you spend a gold coin, calculating the capital gains on that coin, it's ridiculous. So now the other side of the coin, you've given us some optimism. Definitely on the state level, there are some good legislators who support you. There are many people trying to innovate in this regard. However, we see the specter of these central bank digital currencies. And these are almost anathema to freedom, basically. So I don't want to put words in your mouth, but are you working to basically oppose these or to point out their good and bad features?
Me personally, this is an easy one, right? CBDCs have massive shortcomings that I think, undermine fundamental American values about like freedom and the importance of liberty and the importance of privacy. So you've got, between the First and the Fourth and maybe the Fifth Amendment there, you've got constitutional issues. It is a surveillance tool. It's a privacy ridding tool that fundamentally misunderstands the importance of anonymity and privacy in transactions. And maybe it's not that they don't understand it. That might entirely be the point, right? To have that sort of ledger of transactions and being able to have this massive database of all user transactions. And I think that's the point. So insofar as those efforts are being pursued, no, that's not something the Sound Money Defense League would support. Something that I think unfortunately is coming, and it is coming to a head, especially after this FTX debacle. So on the heels of what happened here recently with FTX and the Elizabeth Holmes sentencing, I think that unfortunately we're seeing more and more the claws of the regulators coming out, and they're starting to show their teeth a little bit. And I think they're going to be in a hurry to create this space or to clamp down harder on the space as it exists now. And I think ultimately that's a bad thing for our standards of living, as far as like the money we use is extremely important in its ability to retain value and its ability to be accepted for trade. The money we use is extremely important, and not allowing the best money to be chosen because of things like legal tender laws, because of regulatory burdens, because of IRS or bureaucrats stopping this process, I think is a net negative for humanity.
Yeah, look, mate, there's so much to say about this, and I'm still in shock at the insanity of all the investment in FTX. So many glaring and enormous red flags, right?
This story is unbelievable. You hear more, I read more and more about this story, and I'm like just increasingly shocked that this happened, that there weren't redundancies in place, there weren't safeguards in place, there was nothing to keep, this guy's my age, he's 30 years old, running around managing multi-billions of dollars, just having some friends in a house in the Bahamas. It just doesn't.
Yeah, some kind of polyamorous little... Yeah. Camp out in the Bahamas, harem, and all these people are sending them just hundreds upon hundreds of millions of dollars. And even the Ontario teachers pension plan I think dropped 200 million. Is this insane? I was just thinking, who was doing the research? What?
Who's doing that due diligence? In the United States' case, at least, most pension funds are governed by prudent investor laws. And so there's a list of assets, permissible assets that you are allowed to invest in or you're not allowed to invest in. In most states, things like gold and silver, you're not allowed to invest in. And so we go state to state just trying to include gold and silver to the list of permissible assets. So it is mind-blowing to me that one, somehow FTX or the FTT token were on the list of permissible assets, and no one, just there's this blind chasing of returns that no one for a second stopped to think, wait a second, this doesn't seem right. There's something going on here that isn't adding up.
Yeah, so many red flags. But my big concern is that, like you say, these central bank digital currencies, they're coming. There's a battle on between private and government digital currencies. And I'm not sure how it will play out, but I hope that we can find some sort of digital currencies that work, you know, that function well and can be a competitive alternative, because, as you say, there are grave threats presented by central bank digital currencies. Now, people, if you want to follow JP, it is JP Cortez 27. I was going to say 27, but that's all right. And his website is soundmoneydefense.org. We'll have all the links on the show notes at goldnewsletter.com/podcast. Otherwise, JP, good to catch up, mate. Thanks.
Fergus, thanks a lot. See you soon.